Luke 18:1-18:8 was presented by Jack Crabtree on August 11, 2004 at Gutenberg College's Summer Institute, Making Sense of the Bible. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2004. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle. This is the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side.
We're in Luke 18:1-8, and I'm sure you've read it several times now, so we won't bother to read it. You're familiar with the passage and the issues involved. You probably know, but I've certainly heard this passage taught a number of times to try to convey the idea that what we need to do if we want to get our prayers answered is that we need to persevere in our prayers. And the idea seems to be that the way prayer works is that the first time you pray it, you may not get an answer. The second time you pray it, you may not get an answer. The third time you pray it, you may not get an answer. God is testing your faith somehow, and by faith, the faith that's being tested seems to be more along the lines of your faith in the power of prayer itself or something like that. That is, God is waiting to see whether you believe that prayer actually works. And the only one who's going to keep praying is the one who believes that prayer actually works, so they persevere in the prayer, and finally, ultimately, prayer that is persevered in will be answered. I think that's not an atypical way that people read this parable and understand this passage. I reject that. I don't think that's what's going on. I think this isn't about something entirely different. In fact, I would argue ultimately this isn't even really about prayer. This is about faith, and this is about justice. So when he says, when Luke opens the prayer by saying, now he was telling them a parable to show that at all times they ought to pray and not to lose heart, what does he mean by they ought to pray? I mean, obviously on the surface, that's what leads people to think that this is about prayer. But it's put in contrast to losing heart. And it's crucial to see that. Whatever he means by they ought to pray, it's what they ought not to do is lose heart. Now the question is, of course, what's the context in which we are to understand losing heart? And I think that's where what happens later in the parable and the parable itself informs us of what he means by lose heart. Notice that the parable is about justice, and notice then that in concluding that parable, he talks about how eager God would be to bring justice. Unlike the unrighteous judge in the parable, God is not like the unrighteous judge. Will he not, I think they translate it quickly, he will not delay, will he not quickly will not God bring about justice for his elect who cry to him day and night? Will he delay long over them? He explicitly mentions justice there. So, putting those clues together, how are we to understand what is prompting Jesus to tell this parable? What situation is he speaking into with this parable? Well, I think it's a very familiar situation that the Bible deals with in a number of different ways, in a number of different places. Namely, we live with the reality of living in a world where evil defeats goodness over and over and over again. And evil and injustice is committed and unrecompensed. People don't pay for their injustice. They get away with their injustice. They cheat, they lie, they slander, they hurt other people, and they don't have to pay for it. They seem to get away from it and even to prosper. And you think of all those psalms where the psalmist is saying, God, what's with this? How come the wicked are prospering and the righteous are being stepped on and being smashed? And the prophet saying, how long, O Lord? How long are you going to let this go on? And Kenny and our group pointed out Revelation, where you have the incense of the altar going up that is the prayers of all the saints for justice, which in Revelation is the time when those prayers are going to finally be answered. But those prayers represent prayers over centuries and centuries, over millennia, where the righteous people of God, the people who love God, the people who fear God, have gone with the injustice against them unrecompensed, unpaid for by the wicked. So it seems to me that that's the context that has elicited Jesus' teaching here in this parable, is there's this very, very real and acute human problem that we have to know how to respond to, and that is, what am I going to do with the delayed justice that characterizes human experience? And I think that's why what ought we to pray? This is not a general exhortation to pray here. This parable is not about that. When he says ought to pray, the content is really specified by this parable. Ought to pray for divine justice, for ultimate justice, for final justice. So this is a parable he told them to show them that at all times they ought to pray for ultimate and final justice and not lose heart. So how do we understand the parable itself? I don't think I can generalize to all parables, because parable seems to be a fairly, a relatively large tent. The word parable represents sort of different genres. It's not just one genre. There are significantly different genres under the rubric of parable. A parable almost seems to mean in the New Testament just a kind of rhetorical device, a figure of speech used to teach something else by teaching. You teach something by teaching something else, by explaining something else. And within that label, I think you have a lot of different genres. So every time you come across a parable, you need to allow the parable itself to teach you what genre it is. But there's a very common genre among what are called parables that is represented by this parable, I think, that is really basically what we would call an analogy. Jesus is teaching by analogy. So whenever we're dealing with an analogy, the important thing to realize is it's not an allegory. We're not dealing with symbolism. The characters in the parable don't symbolize God or faith or the believer or something or other. We're not even talking about theology at the level of the story itself. You don't get to theology until Jesus either explicitly or implicitly is saying, now the kingdom of God is like that. So to deal interpretively with a parable, the important thing to do is leave theology out of it to start with and just understand the story as a story. What's the dynamic of the interchange within this relatively ordinary, mundane, ordinary situation that he's describing here? What's the dynamic within that story? And then once we've grasped the dynamic, then ask ourselves the question, and you're saying something about our relationship with God is analogous to that. What is it? And then find the point of analogy. Now, I'm not saying that across the board for all parables. Some parables may be a slightly different genre, but I think that's what this parable is doing. So what's the dynamic in the parable? You've got this judge who, first of all, we have to recognize that this wouldn't be obvious to us in our culture, but in their culture, a widow had absolutely no legal social standing whatsoever. She was utterly and completely powerless. So this judge who is described, Jesus goes out of his way to describe him as not fearing God, not fearing man, having no regard for man, having no regard for justice. This is a totally corrupt, self-absorbed, selfish human being. He doesn't have a love of justice, a single bone in his body that loves justice. And he's confronted with a woman who has absolutely nothing to offer him. So he's not going to do her a favor because she has something that she can give back to him. She has nothing to offer. She's the least of the least in Palestinian society. So he has he has all the freedom in the world to completely brush her off over and over and over and over again. And so what this story describes is that dynamic happening. She comes to him. He doesn't give a rotten fig about her or justice, so he just dismisses her. Go away. Don't bother me. She comes back. Go away. Don't bother me. She comes back. Go away. Don't bother me. She comes back. Go away. Don't bother me. But the one reality, but we have this dynamic. Well, okay, let's stop there. Put yourself now in the shoes of this widow. The widow has a choice at a certain point in this story. she can come to the realization that the judge is a jerk. He does not fear God nor man and has no love of justice in his body. I can go back there again, but I'm going to get brushed off next time just like I've been brushed off the last six times, and can therefore despair, or as Luke puts it, can lose heart. She could lose heart and say, there is no justice to be found. I will find no justice. I give up. Or she can sort of take the position, you know, this guy's a jerk, but he's the judge, and it's the judge's responsibility to give me justice. And since it's the judge's responsibility to give me justice, I'm going to go back. And I have nowhere else to go, but he's the right one to go to, so I'm going to go back and I'm going to get justice because he's the guy you go to for justice. That's what she is represented as doing in the parable, is she doesn't lose heart, she simply returns. Now, why? Because she trusts the judge? In this case, in the story, no, she doesn't trust the judge, but she does trust the office that he represents. She does trust the standing that he has. He's the one whose responsibility it is to give me justice. And it's out of that belief in his standing and in his role and his responsibility that she's motivated to go back. Now, as the story goes then, the judge, not because he repents, not because he turns into a nice guy, not because he finds this newfound love of justice or something, he just wants her out of his hair. And so out of a totally selfish and self-serving motive, he says, okay, yeah, but we'll give you what you need. We'll give you the justice you need and just leave me alone. So he does respond to her, but unrighteously. Well, it's at that point he has this judge respond unrighteously in order to form a contrast that he wants to make with the ultimate judge of all reality, our God. And he forms this important contrast. If this judge, out of selfish motives, gave this widow justice, don't we think, however, that we're in a different position relative to the judge of the universe? Is the judge of the universe not eager to bring justice? Does he not love justice? Does he not want justice even more than we want justice? So, because the God of the universe has the character that he does, we have all the more reason that we would go back and ask our judge for justice than this widow did, because he's one who loves the justice that we want. But then he ends it with, but when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? Well, what is he talking about? And there he's drawing the analogy, I think. Just as the widow in the story is represented as having a kind of faith, if you will, she at least believed in the rightness of her cause, the justice of her cause, and the responsibility of a judge to make things right. She believed that was the case and responded accordingly. Likewise, we are in a position as we confront our lives and our life experience. We experience the injustice of our lives. We have a choice. We can do one of two things. We can ultimately decide that there is no justice to be found. God will not bring justice. He will not do what's right. He's not going to set things right because it's been 50 years already and it hasn't happened. Or we can believe that, I mean, at a bare minimum, we could believe, as the widow does, that, well, it's God's job to do justice. So he needs to do it. But even more so, we can believe that he's eager to bring justice. And out of our understanding, our belief that there is a judge who, both whose job and whose heart is to bring justice, out of that belief, we will, even with the appearance of injustice and justice not being done, we will continue to petition, God, come and bring justice. Establish your kingdom on the earth. Set things right. Don't let evil triumph. Don't let the wicked prosper. And continue in that prayer. And that's I think, the point of the parable. That's what Luke says Jesus is trying to convey, is that persistence in faith, notice not really persistence in prayer per se, but persistence in faith that would manifest itself in my not failing to continue to petition God, God, come and bring justice, bring your justice to the earth. And then that's the picture that you have in Revelation, is that it's those prayers that we keep offering up which feel like they're just evaporating into thin air and not having any effect and going nowhere and being heard by no one. In the end, in Revelation, all of those are the incense ascending up to heaven into the nostrils of God, out of which God finally, in the end, is going to respond, and the judgment that's being described in Revelation is going to come to be. The wicked are not going to be unrecompensed. And Kenny just pointed out in that passage in Revelation, even in that passage, it talks about how even after God's response is not until after a time. Wasn't that how it went? And then after a time, God is going to respond. So even then, it's not immediately in the Revelation passage. There's another passage, I don't even know where it is, but the question came up in our group about what does he mean by without delay? And I would argue that what he's getting at here is he's not really talking about time span. We know that there's a delay. Otherwise, we wouldn't even have the question that this parable is addressing. There's been millennia of delay in God's justice. So how can he talk about there not being a delay when we know there's a delay? What he's trying to do is contrast the heart and attitude of the unrighteous judge as over against the heart and attitude of the divine judge, our God. The divine judge has no internal hesitancy to bring justice. He's not casual about justice. He's not dismissive of justice. He loves justice, and so he's eager to have it come to be. Why is there a delay? There's a delay because, as he puts it in Romans 8, God has purposed, for whatever reason, to call out for himself among mankind, among a sea of human creatures who are vessels of wrath prepared for destruction, to call out to himself a select few of vessels of mercy prepared for glory. But those vessels of mercy prepared for glory are sprinkled throughout time, throughout history as we know it. Every generation has those that God is drawing to himself. And God is not going to destroy the earth and destroy mankind until he has taken for himself those vessels of mercy that he's predestined before the foundation of the earth. And therefore, time has to play itself out before that purpose is accomplished. So I think what Jesus is saying here and elsewhere when he addresses this issue is, when God's merciful purposes toward the elect are accomplished, then you can bet that at the top of his agenda is to bring justice, because that's how much he loves justice. If he's delaying, it's because there's something else he needs to accomplish first that would be precluded by him bringing about justice now. There's a passage, I don't remember where it is, in another passage where he's talking about eschatology. He talks about God moving quickly, and then he says, though he tarry, I shouldn't have started it, but in the same breath, he talks about how God is not going to delay, but when he tarries, don't worry about it. So he's putting in the same breath, God doing something immediately doesn't mean it's going to happen soon. God not delaying doesn't mean it's going to be now. So Jesus is very self-conscious about the time that it's going to take for this to happen. But what he's intent on communicating by the not delay is this subjective commitment on God's part, his eagerness toward this goal and this agenda. Justice is something that God wants to do. So I would summarize the message of this parable. I ought not to despair in the face of the injustices that I suffer in the world and that others around me suffer in the world. Rather, I ought to cry out to God for justice. God is the appropriate one to expect justice from. He is the one who should give it. Hence, I should ask him. And indeed, he will freely and eagerly give it. So it's only logical, it's only natural, it's only appropriate that even though I'm surrounded by injustice, I would never, instead of getting cynical, instead of reaching the cynical conclusion, there is no justice in this world, I instead cry out to God, God, come quickly. God, may your kingdom come on earth, because with that kingdom will come the justice that my heart longs for. Okay. We actually have about 3 or 4 minutes here before we have to break for lunch. Questions that I can respond to? Yeah. Tim?
That last phrase, when the Son of Man comes, what do you think that's a reference to? When he says, will he find faith on earth? Is that the second coming of Christ? Is it now when he's on the earth?
I think it's the second coming, yeah. I think it's what Revelation is describing. The return of the Son of Man to finally establish the kingdom that he's been destined to establish.
And do you think that's a rhetorical question, or do you think he actually thinks there might be...
I think it's a rhetorical question. I think it's a way of saying, to me, the listener of the parable, to say, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on earth? It's a way of saying to me, you're going to despair, or are you going to keep asking? But I think if you take the whole New Testament, I think we have an answer to that. Yes, there will be those who continue to believe.
Jack, why does it say, if it's not about prayer in the first verse, that it is about prayer?
Okay, yeah. That's the crucial lesson I think we need to learn about biblical interpretation, is we have to understand that the Bible is speaking the way human beings speak to each other. And oftentimes we don't say what we mean. I mean, we use language in such a way that we use this word over here to convey this concept over here in a less than straightforward kind of way. Now, it's appropriate to use this word because how else do you cry out for justice except in prayer, right? I mean, that's the appropriate medium, that's the logical medium, that's the way you would describe what I'm doing when I say, God, come quickly, or God, bring justice. God, don't let the wicked prosper. That is prayer. But my point is, he's not making a general teaching about all kinds of prayer across the board. He has a particular prayer in mind, namely the prayer, God, don't let the wicked prosper, bring your justice, bring recompense, punish evil in this world. That's the prayer he has in mind.